Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So good morning, everybody. Koshin asked me to talk about a koan involving the sixth patriarch of Zen, Huineng. So let's start at the beginning and say where the koan is. Okay, koan comes is a Japanese word that comes from the Chinese word kongan, which means public record. And koans are the accounts of the words and actions of Zen masters who lived during the Tang Dynasty, which extended from about 1400 years ago to 1100 years ago. So you might ask, why are these koans relevant? And all I can say is that they've been used for about 1,000 years in the training of Zen monks. The most famous of the collections of koans is one called the Mumon Koan. Mu means knot, mon means gate, and kan means barrier, so it's translated as the gateless barrier. And barriers can be gateless in two senses. One is that there is no way through them. The other is that the gate is always open and it's easy to pass through. And both are true of the koans in the Mumon Koan. When you start working on a koan, it seems like there's no way through it, and when you finish, you say, that's so easy, I should have gotten that immediately. The koan we're going to talk about today is Mumon Koan number 23. There are 48 koans in the Mumon Koan, and each koan has a case, a description of something, and then there is a comment on the case by Zen Master Mumon, and finally there's a verse. So Mumon Koan 23 is called Huineng's Think Neither Good Nor Evil. So I need to say something about Huineng, and the first sentence in the koan, and I'm going to use the translation by the late Robert Aitken Roshi. The koan starts, the sixth ancestor, Huineng, was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiyu Peak. So the question I will first address is, who is the sixth patriarch and why was somebody chasing him? Okay. The problem I have is that I tend to digress, and I know the whole story and I want to condense it today, so to make myself stick to the point and not go off on tangents, I'm going to read. I tell my students that reading is the worst way you can possibly give a lecture, but I'm going to do that today. And there's a lot, actually, of quotes that I'm going to want to use. So a lot of my lecture is going to be read, and I apologize to you for doing that. I'll try and do the best I can, although I'm reading. So, the sixth patriarch was named Huineng, Enno in Japanese. He was born in 638 in the south of China into a very poor family. His father died when he was very young, and consequently Huineng had to sell firewood to support himself and his mother. Therefore, Huineng did not attend school, and he was illiterate. Subsequent scholarship indicates some of the facts about Huineng, including his illiteracy, were probably made up by his biographer, who was one of Huineng's senior disciples. And as one of his senior disciples, he really wanted to put a very positive spin on anything that Huineng did. So what the stories about Huineng probably are part myth. But like many myths, they're too good not to be true. So be warned, this is somewhat mythological, but it's a great story. So one day, Huineng was selling firewood and he heard a monk chanting the Diamond Sutra. at the words, arouse the mind without allowing it to abide anywhere, Huineng had an awakening. Huineng asked the monk where he had learned the sutra, and the monk replied that he'd learned it from his teacher, Hongzhen. Hongzhen Guinin in Japan, in Japanese, was the fifth patriarch of Zen, and he lived in northern China, over 1,000 miles away from where Huineng's hometown was. Nevertheless, in his desire to study under Hongzhen, Huineng was undeterred by this distance. So he found a donor, Huineng found a donor to support his mother, and then he set forth on this 1,000-mile journey walking to seek the instruction from Hongzhen. Hongzhen and Huineng are obviously different names, but they sound sort of the same. And so to keep them straight, Huineng is a young guy. Hongzhen is an old man. Okay? So when Huineng finally arrived at Hongzhen's monastery, the ensuing dialogue revealed Huineng's high level of spiritual development. Nevertheless, Hongzhen sent this young layman from the south off to the temple's granary to haul rice. Huineng had worked in the granary for about 8 months when Hongzhen, who was getting old, announced that he wanted to find a successor. Hongzhen asked each of his 700 monks in the monastery to write a poem showing the depth of their understanding of Zen, and he said he would use the poems to select his successor. All of the monks were convinced by Shen Su, that Shen Su, Shinshu in Japanese, would win, so none of them wrote a poem. So this monk, Shinshu, did not want to enter the competition either, so he wrote his poem on the wall of the monastery without signing it. The essence of his poem was, "The mind is like a mirror bright. Do not let dust on it alight." Hongzhen, master, approved of this poem and told all of the monks to memorize it, but he said nothing about choosing his author, the author Shen Su, as his successor. In the meantime, Huineng, the young layman, heard about this poem, but being illiterate, he had to ask a monk to read it to him. Huineng, too, approved of what the poem expressed, but Huineng thought that it was not penetrating enough. Therefore, he had dictated a poem of his own to the monk and asked the monk to write it on the wall under the poem of Shen Sui. The essence of Huineng's poem was, from the beginning, there is nothing. Where is there for dust to alight? When Master Hongzhen saw Huineng's poem, he realized immediately the depth of its insight, and he knew that only the young layman from the south who was working in the granary could have written it. However, Hongzhen feared what the monks might do if he named Huineng as his successor, so Hongzhen said the poem was worthless, and he rubbed it off the wall with his shoe. Nevertheless, Hongzhen secretly summoned Huineng to his room that night and gave Huineng Hongzhen's robe and bowl as symbols that Huineng was Hongzhen's Dharma successor. However, Hongzhen urged Huineng to flee the monastery. Hongzhen knew that the other monks would think that there were 4 good reasons why Huineng should not be named as Hongzhen's Dharma successor. First of all, Huineng was a layman. Everybody else was a monk. Second, he was young. Probably he was only in his mid-20s. Third, he was illiterate at a time in the Tang Dynasty when literacy was greatly admired. The greatest poems of China come from the Tang Dynasty. And fourth, he was a barbarian from the south. Really bad to be from the south. Northern Chinese considered Southern Chinese to be barbarians. So because of all of these things, Hongzhen was afraid that the other monks would take the robe and bowl from Huineng and possibly even do him bodily harm. Therefore, Hongzhen himself rode Huineng to the far shore of the river near the monastery. In Aitken Roshi's book, if you'd like to look at it, there's a charming painting by the Japanese monk Sengai depicting Hongzhen rowing Huineng across the river. The next day, the monks learned about what had happened the night before, and some of them set out to take the robe and bowl back from Huineng. They were led by the head monk called Ming, Myo in Japanese. He was a former general who had become a monk after his military career had ended. He must have been very strong, because despite Huineng's half-day start, Ming caught up with Huineng at Taiyu Peak, and that's the point at which the koan begins. So here's the case from Mulan Khan 23. The sixth ancestor, Huineng, was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiyu Peak. Huineng, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe and bowl represent the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take them back with you." Ming tried to lift the robe and bowl, but he found them immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe and bowl. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." Huineng said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had a great awakening. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" Huineng said, "What I've just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Hongzhen's monastery, I could not realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I'm like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it's cold or warm. Lay brother, you're now my teacher." Huineng said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Hongzhen our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." So here's Mumon's comment. It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgot himself completely in taking action here. He behaved like a kindly old grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and then puts it in your mouth. You only have to swallow it down. Mumon's verse is, "It can't be described, it can't be pictured, it can't be praised enough, stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." So there are many points of interest in this case, and I will try and highlight them. First, Ming tried to lift up the robe and bowl and couldn't lift them. And you could, I guess, imagine some supernatural power that made them gain weight so he couldn't move them. I think that probably is not right. I think probably Huineng had a spiritual presence that just really awed the monk Ming, and that awe kept him from being able to take the robe and bowl. In fact, he must have been awed because he immediately asked Huineng to teach him. So there must have been something about Huineng, who was, after all, a spiritual genius, that must have really impressed Ming. Ming said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe and bowl. I beg you, lay brother, please teach me." Now, it sounds like Ming isn't quite telling the truth, right? Because he would have been chasing Huineng, and he's now saying, "Well, I didn't come for the robe and bowl." So let me paraphrase what he's saying and change the meaning a little bit so that it becomes true. What I think he was really saying was, "I originally came to Hongzhen's monastery for the sake of the Dharma. I do not desire the robe and the bowl, which are only the outward symbols of the Dharma." This part of the koan is really appropriate for January, when we celebrate renewal. Ming is renewing his commitment to the original reason that he started practicing Zen Buddhism, to understand deeply the Buddha's Dharma and to awaken to his own true nature. We all need this kind of renewal from time to time in order to remind ourselves of the most fundamental reason why we're doing Zazen. The sincerity and simplicity with which Ming said, "I beg you, lay brother, open the way for me," must have indicated to Huineng that Ming had reached a state of ripeness where the right words could bring him to awakening. Remember, Ming was the head monk of this monastery, so he'd probably done Zazen for many, many years, and with the kind of energy and determination that one might expect from an army general. Ming was certainly not a beginner, and his years of longing for awakening and his hard practice in pursuit of this goal made it possible for him to come to awakening at Huineng's well-chosen words. Huineng said to Ming, "Don't think good,
Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming? Let's start with the words, don't think good, don't think evil, and then move on to the talk about Ming's original face. Good and evil are polar opposites, like beautiful and ugly, holy and impure, love and hate. And this is the way that our discriminating intellect works. We carve up the universe into opposites. However, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which we chanted today, says that all things are shunyata, meaning that they're void and empty. The meaning of the word empty, as used here, means that all things are devoid of an intrinsic nature. Accordingly, judgments of good and bad, beautiful and ugly, are qualities that our mind projects onto things, not qualities that are intrinsic to things. So I think this sounds very abstract and philosophical, so let me give you a concrete example, and I'm going to take the example from the book by Robert Wright, Why Buddhism is True. Robert Wright was here this fall and gave a lecture, and what I'm going to read comes from a chapter called A Weedless World. So here's the quote. Several days into my first meditation retreat, I was taking a walk in the woods when I encountered an old enemy. It is commonly known as the plantain weed. Years earlier, when I lived in Washington, D.C., my lawn had been afflicted by this weed, and I spent many hours battling it. I got so desperate that I used weed killer. I like to think that I'm not the kind of person who would devote much time to loathing forms of foliage, but I have to admit that my attitude toward this plant was in some sense one of hostility. Yet now, on this meditation retreat, I was struck for the first time ever by the weed's beauty. Maybe I should be putting the word weed in quotes, because to see a weed as beautiful is to question whether it really should be called a weed. And that is the question I asked myself as I stood there, looking at my former foe. Why was this green leaf thing called a weed, whereas other nearby things that fit the same description weren't? There seemed to be no objective visual criteria that distinguished weeds from non-weeds. In retrospect, I guess I would call this my first close brush with the experience of what Buddhists call emptiness. Unfortunately, we all act on our mind-created distinctions of good and bad, beautiful and ugly. We cease to possess what we think of as being good and beautiful, and we try to avoid what we think of as bad and ugly. In Buddhism, the technical terms for these mind states are craving and aversion. When we don't get what we crave or are forced to accept what we want to avoid, we suffer. We suffer, and we suffer needlessly, because the distinctions that lead to craving and aversion are creations of our own minds. So let me give you an example from my own experience of about 50 years ago. This was back in the 60s when communes were very popular, and I spent a week working on a commune owned by the Rochester Folk Art Guild. And when I arrived, they were putting in a new leach field for their septic system. There was a trench in which a plastic pipe was being laid, and the trench was full of water. From the water came the unmistakable odor of human excrement. It was raining, and the field in which the trench had been dug was muddy. I prayed that none of the water from the trench would seep into the muddy field, make its way through the soles of my boots, and give me typhoid or some other dread disease that comes from contact with human excrement. I can tell you honestly, the thought of having to work on this shitty project for a week caused me huge amounts of suffering. However, realizing that there was no way out of working on this project, I had no choice but to throw myself into wholeheartedly working on it. This provided the way out of my suffering. After a week of working on the leach field crew, I was down in the trench, up to my elbows in the sewage, much more concerned with laying the pipe at just the right angle than whether there might be shit in the water. To tell you the truth, working in that trench, I was really happy. Now maybe you're thinking, Wes, how could you have been happy? You were covered in your elbows in shit, and shit is dirty, shit is disgusting. However, I think you will now recognize that these are just judgments. In fact, shit is just shit. Let me give you another example. Zen master Unman was once asked, what is Buddha? And he immediately replied, a dried-up shit wiping stick. In 10th century China, paper was far too valuable to be used to rub white people's bottoms, so sticks were used instead. I think that perhaps Master Unban was in the toilet when he was asked, what is Buddha? And maybe actually he said nothing. He just held up a shit stick. Unban's shit stick is koan number 21 in the Mumon Khan. In koan number 6, Shakyamuni holds up a flower. Are a flower and a shit stick different? Of course they are. A flower is beautiful and has a wonderful fragrance. A shit stick is ugly and stinks. My wife is really happy when for her birthday I give her a dozen roses. If I gave her a shit stick for her birthday, I think I would no longer have a wife. If you think Shakyamuni held up a flower because flowers are beautiful, then why did Unban hold up a shit stick? Although Shakyamuni and Unban each held up different objects, were they both teaching the same thing? If so, what were they each trying to teach? So now returning to koan number 23, Huineng says to Ming, don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming? Huineng is saying, when you're free from your discriminating thoughts, when you're free from craving and aversion to which they lead, what is your true self? Please notice he doesn't use the word self. That's my paraphrasing. Because unfortunately, self is a highly conceptual word. We use words like self-confident, self-centered, self-aware, self-effacing, self-sacrificing, selfish. Do they all refer to the same self? In fact, in Buddhism, doesn't it say there is no such thing as a self? Original face is much harder to conceptualize than true self. That is why Huineng asked Ming about his original face rather than his true self. In order to avoid any possibility of conceptualization, one of the first koans that are given to new monks in Japanese monasteries is, what is your true face before your parents were even born? Can your discursive intellect grasp what this question might even mean? A new monk has no other option than to focus on this question by doing wholehearted zazen, until finally the monk's sense of self disappears into the questioning. Only then does the monk's face before his parents were born reveal itself. Returning again to koan 23 in the Mumon Khan, sometimes it is formulated a little differently from the version that is given in Aitken Roshi's book. In this alternative version, Huineng asks Ming, when you were chasing me, thinking neither good nor evil, what was your original face? When a student works on this koan through concentrated zazen, the student has to become one with Ming in order to understand and then demonstrate what Ming realized his original face was. The case states, in that instant, when Ming realized his original face, Ming had a great awakening. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows and said, beside these secret words and meanings, is there anything of further significance? What Ming is really asking is there anything further for me to realize? Is this it? This is a common question after a first awakening. It can persist as students begin to work on subsequent koans. When they temporarily get stuck on a subsequent koan, they often think, must be something secret that I missed when I was passed on my first koan. But Huineng answers Ming's question by saying, what you have realized is not secret at all. If you reflect on your original face, whatever is secret will be right there with you. He's saying, there is no secret. Everything is fully revealed. If you doubt this, just return to the question, what is my original face? And the answer will be right there with you. Ming then says, I'm like someone who has drunk water and knows for himself whether it is cold or warm. This is a common expression in Zen. No one can explain the taste of water to you. But when you drink it yourself, then you know for yourself what the taste of water is. No one can explain to you what it's like to come to awakening. To really know what it's like to come to awakening, you have to come to awakening yourself. However, other people's words can give us some clues. For instance, in his song in praise of Zazen, Master Hakuin says, what is there outside us? What is there we lack? Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land, and this very body, the body of Buddha. This is a description how the deeply awakened mind of Hakuin experiences the world. However, until we have experienced the world this way ourselves, these words remain Hakuin's words, not our own experience. Huineng concludes by saying to Ming, maintain your realization carefully. This warning is important because many people naively believe that a first awakening is the end of practice. That is not correct. Without continued Zen practice, a first awakening becomes just a fond memory. A first awakening is not the end of Zen practice. A first awakening is actually just the beginning. Through continued Zazen and work on subsequent koans, an initial awakening experience not only remains alive, but can be endlessly deepened and broadened. In other words, we must keep going and never stop. There's a saying in Zen, there's no beginning to awakening and no end to practice. A more dramatic expression of the same thing is the Zen saying, even Shakyamuni Buddha is only halfway there. Let's now turn to Mumon's comment on this koan. Mumon says, Huineng behaved like an indulgent old grandmother. Not only peels the lychee for her grandchild, but then also removes the seed and pops the fruit into her grandchild's mouth. All the grandchild has to do is to swallow it. As in many of Mumon's comments, what sounds like criticism is actually very high praise. In the verse on this koan, Mumon writes about the original face. It cannot be described, it cannot be pictured, it cannot be praised enough. Stop groping about trying to describe it. Actually, there is no place to hide the original face. So a reasonable question to ask is, if our original face is not hidden, then why is it so hard to find? Ming says, although at Hongzhen's temple, I practiced hard with the other monks, I could not truly realize my original face. How could Ming have missed it if it's not hidden? More importantly, how is it that if our original face is not hidden, we don't recognize it? Mumon explains this very well in the verse to K7 in the Mumon Kan. He writes, because it is so very clear, it takes a long time to realize. In the entrance hall to a Japanese temple, there's a sign that says, look under your feet. Maybe if we ever have our own temple, we can have a sign in the entryway that says, look under your own nose. Finally, Mumon writes that when the world is destroyed, it, our original face, is not destroyed. This appears to contradict Tazui in case 23 of the Blue Cliff Records, who says it is destroyed. Actually, those of you who attended the all-day sitting, last week? Mm-hmm. Yeah, know that there was a comment about koan number 23. So Mumon says when the world is destroyed, our original face is not destroyed. Tazui, another Zen master in case 23, says it is destroyed. Is this a real contradiction? If the world is destroyed, what is our original face? If you can clearly see the answer to this question, you will see why our original face, if it does not stand apart from the destruction, is itself not destroyed. So as I said at the beginning of this talk, Mumon 23 has many interesting points in it. This talk may not have clarified any of these points, but I hope you at least now know what these points are. So thank you for your attention.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.